Welcome. Good evening. Thank you for coming. Oh, and please sit down. As usual, after the lecture, we'll have a short break, 10 minutes or so, and then reconvene those who are interested down the hall, one room, in the junior common room for the question period. My name is Eric Popoli. I'm a tutor and currently director of laboratories at the college, and it is my pleasure tonight to introduce our speaker, Dr. Ben Libeskind. I just wanted to say that. We all get to be Mr. here. Ben graduated from the St. John's campus in Santa Fe in the year 2008. He's currently a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Systems and Synthetic Biology at the University of Texas, Austin. His doctoral dissertation, What Ion Channel Gene Duplications Can Tell Us About the Origins of the Nervous System, won the Outstanding Dissertation Award for Mathematics and the Sciences at the University of Austin in 2014. Ben has published work on evolution and physiology and co-developed a course on computational biology. He has also kept up his liberal arts connections and has led discussion groups at the Thomas Jefferson Center for Core Texts and Ideas on texts ranging from Alan Turing to Plato. And he tells me that Aristotle's Physics is still his go-to book for thinking about biology. He was a fine student, and he's a great guy, and he's also pretty good on the banjo. Please join me in welcoming Ben Libeskind.
Thanks, Eric and everyone for having me out. It's a real pleasure to be here, to be back, and also a challenge. As Eric said, I've been kind of looking at Aristotle's Physics on my off time for years now, and this gave me an impetus and also a necessity to write something about it, and I know people here will be interested in it. So. I'm going to do a bit of a mix today, talking first about some topics in evolution and then sort of go into Aristotle after that. But I want to start on a kind of personal anecdote, because ever since leaving here and starting in evolutionary biology, I've been impressed by a kind of complicated relationship that scientists have with philosophy. Because on the one hand, like a lot of people today, they like to talk about philosophy like it's a bad thing, right? So and when they're describing some kind of meaningless argument, they say, oh, that's just philosophical, or that's just semantic, right? As if words shouldn't have meanings. But of course, what they mean is that philosophy is not rigorous like science is, and that science kind of claims a sort of absolute knowledge. But on the other hand, again, like all people, they like to speculate, especially over beers, and especially about the nature of science and of knowledge. And I don't think I need to convince anyone here that speculating about knowledge over beers is in fact the very root of the philosophical instinct. And so these kind of topics have always been in my mind, if only after work. So the most common thing that biologists, especially evolutionary biologists, like to talk about is whether biology is really somehow distinct from physics, whether it's an autonomous science. Because really, biology, as it's commonly practiced, doesn't fit very well with physics. We just study living things in a different way than we study non-living things. And people who have tried to sort of spell this out in a real way point to a few key features about organisms that make them different from non-living things. And I think people have done a various good job on this, but mostly what they point to ultimately is complexity, right? That living things are extremely complex relative to physical systems. And so that would kind of suggest that biology is really only different as a kind of quantitative way than physical systems. It's just a more complex physical system. But there's also interesting reasons that you can give for why they're different that go beyond that, why it's actually a qualitative kind of break. And so I'm going to just try to give a few of these differences right now, the way it seems to me. So I think the absolute fundamental difference between living and non-living things is that organisms are fragile. And I think this actually gives rise to all the other differences. So because they're fragile, they depend on replication and metabolism to just keep on being, right? Otherwise, they just die. This gives rise to a whole list of other things. So because they replicate, organisms are inevitably a part of some kind of class, right? So for instance, genes are a class, reproducing populations are a class, species, life itself is a class. And the replication is also imperfect, so all living things are unique. They're part of a class, but each one is unique. And because they cannot be, they can die, they also have at least one purpose or function, to not die, or to not die out as a lineage, right, to continue replicating. And so again, this is true for all the parts of organisms as well as organisms as a whole. And the purpose of a part is its function, right? Its function within a whole. And so keep in mind that organisms aren't the only wholes in biology. And organisms can also have functions within ecosystems, that they can be part of a whole in that sense. And that brings us to our next difference. Because organisms are fragile, they depend crucially on the environment, and not just for survival in the sense of, you know, feeding off the environment, but also just for being what they are at all. So for example, what sense does an eye make without light, right? We have to understand organisms in terms of the environment. And so I call that contingency. They're contingent on the environment that they're in. All aspects of living things are contingent, both within the organism and also contingent on the environment, understood as both other parts of the organism and the outside environment. And this is especially important for evolutionary biology. So there's no such thing as the adaptive value of just an eye or a gene considered in isolation. They're adaptations to an environment, and so they're contingent on it. And that leads to our last difference, I think, which is history. You can see I'm kind of going hierarchically from the bottom up here. Living things, they're part of an accumulated history of the process of evolution, sort of an integral over the contingent circumstances over deep time. And non-living things, at least those which are real objects of science, are the same at all times and all places. And that's, I think, an important part of natural sciences is coming to those sort of invariants. Okay, so I mentioned purpose. A lot of my slides are gonna be blank like this. Modern science, of course, was founded in opposition to the sort of medieval pseudo-Aristotelian idea of teleology. But in biology, we can't get by, we can't even take the first step. Yeah. Am I not loud enough? In biology, we can't even take the first step, as it were, without speaking of purpose. And so you might think that this is a problem, but most biologists don't think it's a problem. So the theory of evolution is thought of as a rejection of Aristotelian teleology, because it shows how purpose and forms can come to be from a non-purposive or blind process. But these two aspects of Aristotle's thought that evolution rejects, is teleology and the forms, are both said by him to be causes. And so if evolution disproves Aristotle somehow, it must do so in the realm of causality. But how exactly it does that, how it disproves him, and how it interacts, how evolution interacts with the sort of fundamental explanatory mechanisms of modern natural science, like materialism, determinism, laws of nature, things like that, is very difficult to work out. And that's a bit what I'm trying to do here. So the question I've laid out from the title is how, or in what way, is evolution a cause? And that immediately leads to another question, cause of what? Now, both questions have apparently simple answers, of course. Evolution is how all the living organisms in their particular forms came to be. It's just what happened. But I'll discuss today why I think that this sort of obvious answer has a non-obvious relationship to Aristotle. And I'll focus first on how evolution might be imagined as a cause, but how the just beautiful diversity of life kind of defeats attempts to describe it as a cause. And I'll then claim that evolution, rightly understood, is in fact bringing modern natural science closer to Aristotle, rightly understood. So to show how talking about causality is difficult in evolutionary biology, I'll show you some examples. And before we do that, I want to go over some kind of basic biology to make sure we're all on the same page. I'll start with the DNA. So DNA is the hereditary material. Of course, it's what we pass down to the next generation, more or less naked. Genes are DNA. But DNA is inert in cells. It doesn't do the sort of basic functions of life. And so it gets transcribed as a message in messenger RNA. And the messenger RNA is, we can say, translated by the ribosome into a series of amino acid to make a polypeptide that then folds into proteins. And proteins are just the amazing part of life. So proteins do everything. They bend, they stretch, they undergo all kinds of chemical reactions interact with each other in giant complexes, sometimes transiently or stably, and they move around the cell and so forth. All this work makes cells do whatever they do. And so proteins are responsible for metabolism, muscle contraction, carrying electrical signals like in neurons, making and breaking down other proteins at just the right moment for cell and tissue development, death, and recycling. And all that activity somehow is coded in the sequence of amino acids, which is then encoded in the DNA. So that's the basic molecular biology about evolution. So I said replication is imperfect. So we can have mutations, as you know. And one thing that's important to appreciate is as soon as there's mutations, this is already evolution. Evolution is just changing frequencies of these different variants in populations. So you have a new mutation, you've already changed the frequency. But of course, what most people mean by evolution is if the replication in the next generation is somehow correlated with the particular variants, then you get natural selection, right? And the frequencies change sometimes very rapidly. But what I want to point out is that you can have this change over time without natural selection. It doesn't need to be necessarily selected for. You could just by stochastic processes get changes in these kinds of the frequencies of the different variants. So that's evolution coming from the molecular standpoint. So let's talk about how we talk about causes in biology. So if we want to answer a biological question, why do birds sing in the springtime? It turns out that evolutionary biologists break down causes in a very similar way to Aristotle, four ways, in fact. So we might give these four kinds of answers. We might say because the weather is warming, right, in some kind of way, there's some sort of physiological signal, or talk about physiology in a different way because there's high testosterone in the brain. On the other hand, we might say, well, it's because the bird is part of a class, it's part of a species that sings, and that's, or, you know, and it's a male bird, so that's why it's doing it. It's got genes to do so. And then finally, we might give an adaptive answer. It's adaptive to find mates. It needs to find mates in order to replicate. And so in Meyer and Tinbergen here, these citations, they call these two classes, proximate and ultimate causes. And I think you can see that the ultimate causes map on to Aristotle's formal cause, that's the species, and Aristotle's final cause, that's the adaptive value. And so what evolutionary biologists do for the most part is uncover these ultimate evolutionary causes. And we're very good at it. We do it all the time. But when you start to look at how we do it, I think it becomes clear that the way we mean cause in this sense is quite different than the common understanding. And so the first sort of indicator that we talk about causality differently in biology is that there just aren't any laws in biology the way we talk about in physics. In fact, the more we look at the diversity of life, the more we learn over time, the more and more convoluted the story becomes. And this is especially true in the modern era where we have genome sequencing and all this kind of thing. And so, for instance, one law that people thought might apply to evolution early on is that organisms just might increase in complexity over time, that there's higher and lower organisms, humans, of course, being at the top. And this is a beautiful tree by Ernst Haeckel, made not long after Darwin, that I've sort of ruined in a way by putting all these pictures of organisms, but I just want to orient you in it. Notice that he has it, the tree of life here, broken into three sections. There's the plants, the protists, and the animals. And at the tops, you have the higher forms, like us, and trees. And then below that, lower forms, fungi for him, are just low plants. I think you can tell by the way I'm talking about it, this turns out not to be right at all. But it expresses the intuition that over time, right, organisms just become more and more complex as they go up the tree of life, and that simpler organisms are sort of frozen in time. This is a modern tree, just reinterpreting the exact same species that I've put on there. And the first thing I want you to notice is that I put all the organisms right at the top. So every organism that's alive now has been evolving for the same amount of time, right? No organism that's alive now is the ancestor of any other organism. That doesn't make any sense. And so there's no real higher and lower organisms. But also note the rearrangement. So it turns out that sea urchins up here are more closely related to us than flies are. That seems unintuitive. but it's totally true. And so it's thought that sea urchins actually sort of underwent simplification over time, that they lost central nervous system, for instance, they lost the ability to sense light and so forth. And so this is really important, that life forms can be simplified over time. There's no directionality from higher to lower at all. Other things that are important, sponges are in fact animals, which Aristotle knew, but Haeckel did not. That was a jab. Fungi are more closely related to us than plants are. They're not just low plants, they're actually our close relatives. But the most important thing I want to point out is that the unicellular organisms here, that's a paramecium, this is a coanoflagellate bacteria over here, they're not all together on the tree. There is no kingdom protista. And so what this means is that multicellularity has actually evolved multiple times. This is fascinating. In fact, besides the three that are up here, it's actually evolved probably five times in eukaryotes. So like kelp is an independent origin. And so we call this convergent evolution, when things sort of converge to look the same. The main point I want to get here is that the way taxa just look to us doesn't necessarily reflect their history. And in fact, convergent evolution turns out to be really, really common, much more common than anyone thought, and we're just sort of finding this out now. Another example of convergent evolution that I love are eyes. So eyes that have lenses and have a chamber have evolved independently in vertebrates and in cephalopods, such as the octopus there. And in fact, not just in these two, but some jellyfish have eyes, which you might be surprised to learn. Creepy eyes like that with the lens looking down. And in fact, there's even a class of unicellular organisms that have eyes with lenses. This is a single cell with a lens and a pigment cup right underneath it. These are closely related to the protists that cause red tides if you live near the coast or something. So convergent evolution is everywhere, even in very complex structures like this. And so, of course, no biologist now would claim that evolution has any kind of rational historical basis from higher to lower. But we might still think that natural selection itself has a kind of directionality, or that it makes organisms better over time, right? This is what eugenicists thought. Unfortunately, a lot of the founders of modern genetics were also eugenicists. But that also turns out not to be true. And so what I want you to keep in mind is that natural selection, as I showed you before, it really just sees fitness. It just sees the ability to replicate. It doesn't see eyes. It doesn't see feathers, right? So when we talk about eyes being selected for, it's actually a misnomer. Only the ability to replicate is ever selected for. So we need some other explanatory mechanism to really explain the particular features. Why do we have eyes? Why do we have the forms that we have? And so one way that we're doing this now in modern biology is to sort of mix the physiological proximate causes with the ultimate causes. And this is molecular evolution. We try to understand how the parts, the proteins, came to be. And this is my field, in fact, but I'm not going to talk so much about my work because I don't want you all to fall asleep. So an example, again, from eyes. Eyes are, the lenses here are packed full of proteins called crystallins. So what is a crystalline? It turns out that it's different in lots of different species. And so all vertebrates have, these are the species here that the crystallins are in, and these are classes of crystallins in some strange language that I don't recognize. All vertebrates seem to have A and B, alpha and beta crystallins. But then you see these other ones, just they're in some birds and reptiles. The pie ones just are in only diurnal geckos, right? So this doesn't mean that eyes and vertebrates have had to re-evolve multiple times. It just means that the eyes have stayed the same over evolution. They've just been switching out the crystallins that are in the lenses. So this is called systems drift. The phenotype, the form, stays the same, but the proteins that make it up change. And so this actually makes it impossible to have a kind of law mapping from the proteins to the phenotypes. Jacques Monod had a really interesting, I want to add one more thing, that all these crystallins also do other things. So this is a bunch of gobbledygook about how they're enzymes, but the point is that these enzymes have been recruited to the eye in all these different species. And so this kind of sharing of genes, the ability to recruit them to different properties, Jacques Monod called gratuites. I'm sorry, that's a little far down. But the fact that, the molecular structure of proteins isn't really uniquely determined by their function, he calls a gratuite, as if to say that they have this sort of freedom. And he went on to say that because of that, because proteins display this property, anything is possible. Think about that statement. Anything is possible. And in fact, on closer inspection, this property doesn't just exist in proteins, it's all over biology. So if we were talking about this earlier, Eric, that Broca's area, the part of the brain, you have language processing, you'll see pictures in textbooks like this over here on the left temple. In fact, this is only true for about 70 to 95% of people. The rest of people actually have it on the other side, especially left-handed people have Broca's area on the other side. And some small number of people, I'm sorry, I just had to sort of put this over there, actually don't have Broca's area at all. And the language processing is spread out through the whole brain. And what's important here to note is that these people have no difference in their speech. There's nothing recognizably different about them. It's just this kind of idea of systems drift or gratuite, right, on a different level, not on the evolutionary level, but just within the population of humans and with a very complex function. And so the takeaway is this, right, that functions, they can be performed by multiple kinds of functional parts that can be switched in and out. And so Monod, in the same book where he defines this idea of freedom, gratuite, says, quote, "The biosphere does not contain a predictable class of objects or of events, but rather constitutes a particular occurrence, compatible indeed with first principles, but not deducible from those principles, and therefore essentially unpredictable." Evolution is essentially unpredictable. That book is called Chance and Necessity, the subtitle of which is A Philosophy for a Universe Without Causality. I think he was kind of onto something there. How do we talk about causality if anything is possible? I think this kind of shows how we have to understand the parts of organisms in terms of the whole and not the other way around. I'll come back to that a little bit later. So Monod and others have made the point that, of course, these special features in biology don't really make it incompatible with physics, because organisms don't violate any fundamental laws. And so what people tend to say is that just means we have to expand our understanding of what science is to include the way that we do biology. And so for instance, that might mean elevating post hoc explanations over prediction, or allowing at least some kind of flirtation with the idea of teleology. I'm not sure it's so easy. So for one thing, if we always have to understand the parts of organisms or organisms themselves within the context of some whole, like proteins within the context of the organism, organisms within the context of the environment in evolution, then what are these wholes that we're talking about? Don't we have to consider them to be some kind of new class of scientific object that physics doesn't really consider? And we also just can't imagine that these problems exist only in biology. Compare these two quotes. So I just gave you this one, the biosphere, with this other quote by a physicist, Philip Anderson. So the reductionist hypothesis does not by any means imply a constructionist one. The ability to reduce everything to fundamental laws does not imply the ability to start from those laws and reconstruct the universe. So it's the exact same intuition as Monod, except he's a condensed matter physicist. And so it just turns out that this is a rife throughout of all of science. And, it's a bit histrionic or something to say that this is a crisis or that science is in a crisis. But at the same time, I think what we're seeing is science sort of steadily working out what we really do mean by cause, and don't we sort of have to consider some other ways of thinking about things if we're going to study complex things and especially biological things. And so these kind of considerations will led me to continue reading Aristotle and to try to spend a little more time with him. Because after all, he talks about these things in great details. He talks about parts and wholes, about causes, about the possibility of any true understanding of nature, and about the status of living things in the study of nature. And I've become more and more convinced that Aristotle really hasn't been understood very well, especially by scientists. And so I want to share with you a bit of my thinking on this, however imperfect, because I feel that if he's read right, Aristotle, and especially the physics, can be really helpful for these questions. And I've been convinced, as Mr. Popley pointed out, that actually the physics is the greatest work of biology that's ever been written. So I'll leave behind the slides now and just start talking. So as many of you will be aware, Aristotle is often mistakenly construed as some kind of representative of pre-scientific thought. But in fact, his writing, especially the physics, as well as the metaphysics, takes the form of some kind of a response to the pre-Socratic philosophers, whose opinions about nature really overlap those of modern natural science. And so they were materialists, they were determinists, they were atomists, and so forth. And so the Socratics looked these kinds of philosophies of natural science in the face and rejected them. So the physics, I think, is particularly relevant for evolutionary biology, because right there in Book 2, Chapter 8, Aristotle rejects the origin of species by means of natural selection, at least as Empedocles had imagined it. And so to properly understand this rejection, we have to first discuss Book 2 a little more generally so that we can see how Chapter 8 has a part in it, and then we'll look at Chapters 8 and 9 in grueling detail. So Book 2 contains many of the famous aspects of Aristotle's thought. So it begins with a general definition of nature and of natural beings. Natural beings are living things in their parts, and the fundamental elements, such as fire, water, all those, are also natural beings. And so to be a natural being, a thing has to have within itself a source of motion that's proper to it. In the case of organisms, I think it's immediately clear what it would mean to say that they have the source of their own proper motion. With the elements, Aristotle points out that the materialists disagree about which is the primary substance, earth, fire, water, whatever. And it seems that we only know them, or at least we primarily know them, through unnatural things, artifacts like a cloak or a bed that obviously don't have a source of motion, proper motion within themselves, and can be decomposed into constituent parts. Nearly all the examples of natural things in natural motion in Book 2 are organisms, or by analogy, of art. And so living things play a central role in Aristotle's concept of nature, and I'll try to make the case that we can't really understand his doctrine of causes either if we don't understand that role. Excuse me. So his famous account of the four causes, the material cause, the moving cause, the formal cause, and the final cause, these are also in Book 2. And after he introduces them, he moves on to an account of chance, and whether and how chance is a cause. Then after that, Chapter 7, there's a restatement, and importantly, a re-rendering of the four causes. And so he says that often, the what it is, the formal cause, and the that for the sake of which, the final cause, are one. And that from whence the motion first is, that's the moving cause, is one in species with these. Species is translating eidos there. Some people translate form, but I'm going to translate it species to keep it distinct from the what it is and morphe, which I will translate as form. So a case where these three causes collapse into one, an example, is a human being bringing forth another human being. And he says, in general, as many things as cause motion while being moved themselves. And that whatever is not like this does not belong to the study of nature. For it causes motion not by having motion or a source of motion itself, but by being motionless. And so he establishes the study of nature as a study of things that move and are thereby moved themselves, the prime example of which is a human being replicating. So we can imagine what it means to say that organisms combine in some way the moving cause, the formal, and the final causes all within themselves, especially when we consider replication. And so, you could say they're moved by some internal source to copy their form, and that the mature form is itself a sort of end or a good. But he also has just hinted here that there are things which cause motion but are not themselves moved and are hence outside the study of nature. So what are these? It turns out there are two sources of natural motion. One of them is not itself natural. Bewilderingly, this unnatural source of natural motion turns out to be the what it is, or form. And that because it's an end and for the sake of which. And so the formal and final causes, which remember he had said collapse into one, now seem to fall into the class of things which are not natural and not an object of natural science. He doesn't clarify here what the other source of natural motion is. It could be the material cause, or it could also be the moving cause. Because remember, this has been said to be one in species with the collapsed formal and final cause, but not just one simply the way those two are. Anyway, so at this point, it's clear that living things are a special case of causality somehow, and that they contain both natural and unnatural sources of motion. And so now we have to understand first how an unnatural cause, like this static, unmoved formal slash final cause, can bring about natural motion, or to say it a different way, how nature can be for the sake of something unnatural. Second, how this unnatural source of motion can be said to exist in the same species as the moving cause, and what in fact the moving cause is, because it's very unclear. And finally, we have to figure out how material causation comes into all this. So chapters 8 and 9, which are the last two chapters of book 2, explicitly take up the first of these tasks anyway, that of showing, as he says, why nature is among the causes for the sake of something. But then in classic Aristotelian fashion, he adds a completely different task, which is we have to now ask about necessity and how it holds a place among natural things. And so in looking at and comparing nature as necessity and nature as a cause for the sake of something, we'll also end up answering our other questions about how organisms are objects of natural science, and we'll clarify this redefinition of the causes that we just spelled out. Okay, so why does he add in necessity? So we have to examine necessity, as he says, because everybody traces things back to this cause, to necessity. For even if they speak of another cause, whether it be friendship and strife, that's Empedocles he's talking about, or mind, that's Anaxagoras, they just send it on its way after only so much is touching on it. So he might mean two things, I think, by this. He may mean that the doctrines of causes associated with the schools of Empedocles and Anaxagoras, and indeed all natural philosophers, aren't really meant to be taken literally, and that they really just thought necessity is the only cause. But he could also mean that everybody somehow traces back to necessity sort of unwittingly, and not to necessity as a cause itself, but as an essential criterion of a cause. A cause is a necessary and sufficient condition of the effect. Either way, it's clear that necessity has to be understood if we're going to understand causes now, because it's fundamental. And we should also keep in mind the question of whether Aristotle meant to include himself in the everybody that traces things back to necessity. So he now introduces one way that we might think about necessity. So he says, here is an impasse. What prevents nature from doing things not for the sake of anything, nor because they're best, but just as Zeus reigns, not in order that the grain might grow, but just out of necessity. And so one way we might understand necessity, the deterministic universe, is by way of contrast with the human good, the grain growing. It's a sort of natural extension of the idea that there are gods who don't really keep our interests in mind. They just rain on us willy-nilly. I think this is an important way that necessity is thought about. But it's also the last time that the human good is mentioned here. But let's keep it in our memory, because he now bridges from the idea of the human good, the grain growing, to the idea of good or purpose in living things and in their parts. And this is where Empedocles' account of the origin of species is introduced. So Aristotle now says, what prevents the parts in something that is by nature from being the same way as the rain? Say, the teeth just growing, the front ones sharp out of necessity, suitable for tearing, but not really for the sake of this, just falling together. And likewise with the other parts, wherever anything happened to just come together just as if it had been for the sake of something, these were preserved, having been put together advantageously by chance. And anything that's not like this perishes, and still perishes, just as Empedocles says of man-headed cattle. The Empedoclean myth he's talking about here, the parts of animals, the hands, the feet, the foreheads, everything, just rises up and come together in all these monstrous combinations, like the man-headed cattle, and that the non-advantageous ones just die out. So this is a legitimate idea of evolution by means of natural selection, but with things rising up from the earth. But he rejects this account, saying that it's impossible for things to be this way. For all things that are by nature come about as they do, either always or for the most part, and none of the things from fortune or chance do. For it does not seem to be from fortune or coincidence that it rains often in the winter, but it does if this happens in the dog days of the summer. If, he then says, it seems that something is either by coincidence or for the sake of something, and if things by nature can't be by coincidence, then they have to be for the sake of something. Unfortunately, there are a lot of problems with this argument, right? So first off, he bases it in terms of what seems or is reputed to be the case, not what is or must be. Second, keep in mind, he's only replying to Empedocles' assertion that the parts came together by chance, not that they grow by necessity, which he hasn't mentioned yet. And so he had said, if something is either by coincidence or for the sake of something, and nature is clearly not something coincidental, then nature has to be for the sake of something. What if it's neither for the sake of something or by coincidence? It's just by necessity, just as Zeus reigns. He leaves this possibility open. Finally, his rejection of Empedocles is based on the evidence that the parts of animals come to be predictably during their development. But Empedocles' myth seems to account for this the same way we do now. Animal parts seem to be end-directed in their development, but it's just the accumulated action of natural selection. It's just preserved chance, preserved because it's beneficial for reproduction. And so Aristotle conflates the two types of coming to be in biology. One, the coming to be during development, which is clearly repeatable and in some sense end-directed, and the coming to be by evolution, which is neither. And so we can't really say for sure whether he's aware of this conflation, but let me propose that he is, and that the other glaring weaknesses of the argument here suggest that he didn't mean to wholly reject the idea that the origins of animals could be due to chance, and that the conflation of these local regularities of development in individual organisms and their parts with evolution is meant to point us towards a really central problem, whether the status of organisms as wholes with the parts adapted to the purpose entailed by that whole is in fact in conflict with a broader understanding of ends in nature that reaches beyond organisms. But this isn't to say that he just agreed with Empedocles. Instead, a few lines later, he says that the primal, undifferentiated forms in Empedocles' myth were in fact seeds. He also says that someone who claims that any random thing can arise in seeds abolishes nature and what is by nature. Now, this unusually strong statement is, I think, meant to draw our attention back to the question of chance. Because the phrase that he uses here, any random thing coming to be in seeds, is not the same as chance, which had received the extended treatment in chapters 5 and 6. Instead, it comes from the verb meaning to hit the mark. And so Empedocles, I think, was wrong because he confused these two ideas. Arms and heads don't just randomly come together. Hitting the mark, making a human with a human head. He, Empedocles, can't give any account of how an animal might undergo consistent development because there's no principle of concerted action in the dissociated limbs. They just came together. But chance, as Aristotle had defined it in Book 6, is in fact a cause that acts on natural beings from the outside, producing an effect that is not, in fact, for the sake of what actually happens. And chance can certainly act on seeds in this way, right? Aristotle gives an example himself, namely the idea of congenital defects during development, which you know everyone knows exists. And so I don't want to just force Aristotle into agreement with the idea of modern evolution. He never gives any indication, for instance, that he believes in the possibility of beneficial deviations from the purposive potential in seeds. But it is suggestive that he associates seeds, which, by the way, play a big part in Book 1, the seeds he comes back to over and over again, that he associates seeds with Empedocles' undifferentiated forms, which, remember, are the precursors to modern animals. And so I do think that he leaves open the possibility that the origin of species as they are now could be due, in some sense, to chance, but only if it's properly understood. So chance implies the prior existence of form. And chance deviations have to be deviations from something. And that something is the internal purposive action of individual organisms, sort of modeled as seeds. And now Aristotle takes up this idea in much greater depth. So recall that it was not clear to us whether the purposive motions of organisms reflect teleology and nature more generally. And now Aristotle says that nature acts for ends, in fact, in the same way that human art does. And animal artists, like spiders and ants, are the clearest indication that nature is a cause for the sake of something. but they do this art without deliberation. And of course, our art does include some kind of deliberation, some idea, prior picture of the end that's in our minds. Nevertheless, he says, it's clear that there is such a cause for the sake of something, in things that come into being and are by nature. So notice that he's quietly now restricted the final cause to things that are by nature and come into being, which is just living things. Because in book 2, chapter 1, where he was talking about the natural beings, the animals, the part and their parts, and the simple bodies, the elements, the simple bodies, which the materialists considered to be all of nature, were eternal. And in fact, it's precisely their status as eternal elements that make them a principle of nature, because they persist through all change. And so this idea of first eternal material underlying motion is said to be nature. But Aristotle then says there's in fact a twofold meaning of nature. There's the elements and there's also form. But now he gives no indication that the elements can actually have a final cause themselves. Instead, he redefines material, and it's now said to be for the sake of form. And it's defined, in that sense, by the form and end, which can somehow now be said to be prior to material in some way. The form is prior to material. So this is a radical departure from the idea that the elements are eternal and that the forms are, in some sense, just mere dispositions of the elements. In fact, nearly the reverse is true. Material is almost a sort of a particular instantiation of a form. And so just like chance, it turns out we can't know material without the forms and the ends. And he invites us to think of nature somehow as gathering together the material for the form and the end the same way we do in art. But as I said, art entails deliberation. And someone could therefore object that all things that act for ends in some sense deliberate. But since spiders and plants, they don't deliberate, they just do. And yet they have a nature, then nature can't act for ends because there's no deliberation. To this objection, Aristotle gives a very strange reply. He says that even art doesn't deliberate, because if the shipbuilding art were in the timber, it would act by nature the same way. This is, of course, what he set out to prove, that nature acts like art. But the next line is more revealing. He says that this is most clear when someone cures himself, for nature is like this. Now, Aristotle often uses the example of a doctor and the medical art. Apparently, his father was a doctor. So does the internal source of motion in organisms, their purposive action towards the mature form, act in some way like a doctor might operate on himself, use his art, and then sort of use whatever material he needs to make that end? To understand whether this is true, we have to look again back to the beginning of book 2, where he says that nature is a principle of motion and of rest in that which it is primarily and not coincidentally. I say not coincidentally because someone who is a doctor might become a cause of health for himself. But still, it's not according as he is healed that he has the doctoring art. But it just happens to be that the same one is the doctor and is healed. So what are we to make of this? Nature is, in fact, not like the doctor applying his art to himself, because the art of doctoring can somehow be separated from the person that has it. Instead, it's to be associated. Nature is to be associated with the innate potency to be healed, because that just can't be separated from a human being. And so here at the end of chapter 8, where he had said that nature is like someone curing himself, this is almost like comedy, right? That nature is in fact like someone curing himself who doesn't know what he's doing. So I think even here, where he seems to be saying that nature is like art and purposive, he's still maintaining a distinction between the inner potency of organisms, that inner sort of moving cause, whatever it is, and art-like purposive action, just techne, right? And techne has to include deliberation and forethought of the end. And this distinction merely maintains the one that we've been discussing all along, the concept of an unnatural final cause on the one hand and some other natural cause on the other, whatever it is. And so we had left it open whether the material cause or the moving cause was this natural cause of natural motion. But Aristotle has now said that the material is for the sake of the end, thus kind of relegating it to a mere component of the final cause. And so let me now suggest that Aristotle believes that the internal genetic source of motion in animals is the natural source of motion. The moving cause is the natural source of motion, not material. and the source is sort of compared to seeds. Seeds are moved themselves as they move the organism, right? Namely, they're used up during growth. But it's also clear that this internal genetic principle of organismal development is not indirected the same way that art is. It has a potency that sets organism in motion, to be sure, but we should not imagine that it acts with deliberation or techne, having some picture of the end. And so Aristotle certainly wouldn't have been a fan of our analogy of genes as blueprints, for instance. So the natural source of natural motion, the moving cause, which is likened to a seed, is still, even here, separate from the formal slash final cause. So now I think this all becomes clear in chapter 9, which is the last chapter of book 2. And here he takes up again the question of necessity. So apparently all of Aristotle's contemporaries thought of necessity as residing somehow in the coming to be of things, as if, Aristotle says, someone were to think that a wall came to be by necessity because the heavy things are carried down and the light things up. So the foundations are down and the timber furthest up because it's lightest. But he says necessity doesn't really flow from the parts to the holes in this way, as if a wall were just to spring up from stones or a saw spring up from iron. Instead, Aristotle says, necessity flows from the whole to the parts. If a wall or a saw are to be what they are, then the stones and the iron must be or are. And because the house and the saw came to be for the sake of something, not just through the stones and the iron, these things, the stones and the iron, must be present as material if the saw and the house are to be. And thus he reiterates his understanding of material as being for the sake of ends, and also now locates necessity in the material. And so necessity, along with material and chance, must be understood through the final cause. And this is a radical statement, if we really think about it. Remember, he'd said that everybody traces all the causes back to necessity. So now, where he takes up necessity again systematically, he gives no indication that he is not himself part of this everyone. And so we must interpret him as saying that all the causes must be thought of in light of the that for the sake of which, the final cause. Because it's only the final cause that entails necessary things and necessary processes. And because necessity is not in the coming to be of things, understanding the coming to be of something is not, after all, to understand the thing itself. We must know the final cause. This, of course, is only really a clarification of what's typically meant by calling Aristotle's physics teleological. Indeed, he seems to be saying that ends, and therefore also the forms, which, you know, those two had been collapsed, are imminently present in nature somehow, collecting together the necessary material to produce the end. And so we'd be justified in thinking once again that animals are the prime example of this, and that they sort of consume material in order to maintain themselves in metabolism. But I'll claim that here, still, Aristotle's maintaining a fundamental disconnect between the forms and the inner working of natural beings, because we have to read the analogies very carefully. Although he's invited us to think that forms necessitate the coming into being of their proper material, both of his examples, the saw and the house, are not themselves ends. They are for the sake of something else, say shelter in the case of a house. And so it's their function in producing this end that necessitates their material composition. So forms entail functions, and functions entail necessary composition. Forms don't directly entail necessary materials. And so forms still stand at least one step removed from the material world and causality. But how do the forms entail functions? Well, he now says that this is by the definition and the account of the thing, that is, by logos. This then, at last, at long last, is the explanation for the unmoved, unnatural, formal slash final cause. It's the definition of a thing, our definition of a thing. It's not an imminent and active cause responsible for the growth and subsistence of organisms. So, is Aristotle then really just another materialist, sort of only seeming to claim that the forms are real, but that they're in fact imaginary, put there by us? Does he just make up definitions of material and necessity to fit that picture? I don't think that's true. The claim that necessity is not in the coming to be of things is, I think, a real challenge to our understanding of nature, as is the claim that necessity, material, cause, and chance all have to be understood in the light of final causes. Causes other than the final cause are best understood not in the coming to be of something, but as necessary conditions of beings that would otherwise not be or not be what they are. Only fragile things, things that cannot be, have necessary conditions and hence causes. So by taking these claims seriously, we can actually answer the mystery of how this unnatural, not to say imposed, formal slash final cause produces natural motion while itself being unmoved. What he means is that an account of natural motion, of which causes and necessity and by negation chance are a part, entails a prior knowledge or intuition of beings and hence ends. Let's call it a pre-scientific intuition. And we can't just assume that these intuited ends are not, in fact, in natural beings. Because our intuitive sense that beings are and have ends may ultimately come from our own sense of ourselves as fragile beings that persist through change, just barely holding on. And yet we also have a suspicion, a pre-scientific suspicion, perhaps, that the universe may not have ends the same way we do, and that it does not, after all, reign just for our benefit. But we can't even have this intuition if we don't already understand what it means to be for our benefit. And if our suspicion is true, we shouldn't think, that is, if the suspicion is true that nature doesn't have ends, we shouldn't think, as modern natural science does, that we can arrive at an authentic causal understanding of the world. For such a causal understanding presupposes ends. And if we follow our intuition that living things have ends the same way we do, we can perhaps come to an authentic causal understanding of the parts of animals and of their proper functions. And such an understanding is much more tenuous when it concerns the inorganic world, because who can be said to understand the final cause of the cosmos? So I imagine this is as unsatisfying to you as it is to me. Is there no real proof that we can give that our intuition about the existence of nature and natural beings is correct? And that our suspicion about the uncaring universe is unfounded? We must, for the last time, go back to the beginning of Book 2. Aristotle says there, it's absurd to try to show that nature exists, for it is apparent that among beings there are many such things, natural beings. Showing what is manifest through what is not manifest is being unable to distinguish what is known through itself from what is not known through itself. And yet, he says, it is possible to suffer this. Someone that's blind from birth might reason about colors, but it's necessary that for such people, an argument about colors is about names and without understanding. Some people are just blind to beings, even though they're what's most apparent, and these people reason only in abstractions. This is the closest we get to a proof, I think, that nature and natural beings really exist in Aristotle. But it is, I think, a powerful call to modern natural science. Are we going to be happy to study the world of abstractions, or are we going to try to study the world of beings? That's all I have. Thank you all for listening.